and welcome back to another episode of Franklin Covey's twice weekly podcast on Leadership with Scott Miller. That's me. I'm your host for 6 years, sitting in this chair on this set with a phenomenal production team. Each week we have Travis Rust and Brandon Stone and Ty Schmidt and others churn out some of the most compelling interviews, not because of my talent, but because of the expertise of the guests that On Leadership is able to shine their spotlight onto every Tuesday and Friday for now what is over 350 episodes, all dedicated to making you a better leader. Today, I'm delighted to introduce to you a Harvard Law School professor and founder of Triad Consulting Group. Her name is Sheila Heen, and she's the co-author of a very important book called Difficult Conversations, How to Discuss What Matters Most. This is a topic that we've actually spotlighted in other episodes on this podcast, including this year, because we think it is a crucial leadership competency. I mean, heck, this is a crucial human competency, parenting competency, having difficult conversations, moving outside of your comfort zone, discussing the undiscussables, arguably one of the most imperative skills that leaders have to invest in and grow their people, to have conversations that help people be aware of how they are or are not being perceived and how it is aligned with what they think their intent or technique is. Sheila Heen from Harvard University, welcome to On Leadership.
Thank you so much. What a wonderful introduction.
Well, that's gracious. You deserve it. This book has been in print, I think, for nearly a decade. It's the third edition. It really is a seminal book in the space. Am I right that it's the third edition?
It is the third edition, and it's been 25 years.
25 years?
Yeah, it first came out in 99.
With the same three original authors?
Yes.
Well, it's remarkable. Yes. I mean, it shows the staying power of this book, because I just discovered it in the last couple of months, and it's a topic that is very near to my heart, because I think it's one of probably the two most important things that leaders do. In fact, I'm pretty a pretty strong evangelist that I think the number one contribution leaders make is to recruit and retain talent. I think the number two most important contribution is giving people feedback on their blind spots and having difficult conversations, hence Kim Scott's book around radical candor and all of the body of knowledge around it. Sheila, will you rewind 25 years or so and reorient your professional journey for all of our listeners so we can level set and get into some of the important aspects of having difficult conversations?
Well, absolutely. And I could not agree with you more about just the central role that difficult conversations plays in leadership. And what's interesting to me is that I think early on, as a student and a young professional, I thought that, well, eventually when I have enough experience or enough confidence, you know, I won't have difficult conversations because I'll just be so good at them. And the funny thing is how long it took me to realize that as you go up the ladder and become more and more senior in any organization, you actually spend more and more of your time having difficult conversations, because it's the issues that get kicked upstairs for you to handle that don't have simple answers or that are systemic challenges and often are there because people have avoided a lot of conversations up until this point. So for me, part of the journey of the last 25 years has been just understanding the role that those conversations play in organizations and also in our personal lives, and the struggle to walk our own talk, right? As we ourselves are in positions of leadership, are in relationships with other humans, and we bring all of our history and all of our weaknesses and blind spots with us into those relationships.
I'll reinforce what you said. I think although the higher up you are on the ladder in the organization, the more difficult these conversations need to be and more imperative they are, I would argue it's almost always because of neglect. It's the neglect of someone more junior that lacks the skill, that lacks the training, that lacks the courage, but also lacks the understanding that this is incumbent upon you as a leader. If you can't have difficult conversations, then you can't have a leadership position. Heck, you probably can't have a parenting position or a marriage position. Why do you think it's so neglected?
Well, I think that when we are thinking about whether to have a conversation, all of our fears of sort of, if I raise this, or I've tried to raise this before and it hasn't gone well, are kind of in technicolor. Like, I don't want to jeopardize the relationship. I don't want to demotivate this person. I know that I and a board member disagree about this. So do I want to have that argument or not? Or do I just find a workaround? I think that the consequences of raising are very vivid in our minds and imaginations and experience. The consequences of avoiding are quieter. They're no less corrosive, but they accumulate slowly and quietly over time. So we, in fact, do jeopardize the relationship. We are still in conflict with other people. We just don't know why. We don't learn anything about, well, why do we see this so differently or have different predictions strategically about the future, et cetera. But on any given day, human beings are short-term decision makers, right? Do I have time to tackle that conversation today?
My wife will tell you that I love difficult conversations. She will tell you I'm a heat-seeking missile searching out difficult conversations. I'm that kind of rare breed that tends to be very comfortable with that because of 30 years of practice. And in fact, I think it's such a pervasive issue. Franklin Covey released a solution a few months ago called Navigating Difficult Conversations for Our Clients because it's such a pervasive issue. Let's talk about some of the reasons why people avoid them. In your book, you talk about stop arguing about who's right. And let's talk a bit about that because this is, as we enter a vitriolic political campaign, wait, every campaign now is vitriolic, so this is the new norm. Do you have anything to offer our listeners and viewers as they're gearing up for the campaign here in the U.S. and for that matter, political campaigns across the world? Why do we tend to enter conversations focused on who's right? I'm guessing we think we are and they're not. Explore that and unpack that however you'd like.
Yeah, well, so part of the calculus of should I raise this or not has to do with our sense of, well, how sure am I that I'm right about this? And partly because the conversation itself feels like such a mess and is so unpredictable because we don't know how the other person's going to react. Will they cry? Will they yell? Will they disagree? Will they complain to others and triangulate the conflict so that I've got an even bigger problem now? I think that what we're right about feels like the calm in the storm. It feels like certainty is our shelter. When in fact, certainty ends up hindering our ability to even understand the problem. So part of the shift is shifting from focusing on what I'm right about to being curious about why we see it so differently. If I can walk into a conversation and think, okay, my purpose, my first purpose is just to understand why is it that we see this differently? Or to find out, do we see it differently? And if so, is that because we're looking at different things, because we have access to different information? Is it because we're interpreting them differently? We're looking at the same thing, but our past life experience means I predict this is going to be a disaster and you predict, oh, it'll be fine in the end. If we can understand why we see it differently, and also I can see the things you see that aren't available to me, now I actually have more of the puzzle pieces of the whole picture, and I'm in a better position as a leader to understand the problem and then together for us to decide what to do about it.
I think that was beautifully said. I don't know of a person that isn't sort of girding their loins for the coming presidential campaign, right? I mean, I know people that are on one side that vote for the other and people that are on this side that don't vote for the other. And only, everybody's got a coping mechanism right now. We're gearing up for how we keep our families together. How do we keep friendships that now we're wondering, should I even have this friend in my life because they see it so differently? And some of this is like, it's the protection of democracy. It's the protection of capitalism. It's life or death. One of the ways in which I have matured slightly at 56 through the U.S. political vitriol is really trying to understand what does this person believe that I don't and why? To your point, what information do they have access to? What paradigm, what belief, what mindset was inculcated in them by their parents or their rabbi or their headmaster that I didn't believe? And I think I've come to realize people behave the way they do for reasons. Usually they're rational, but it's access to information or a narrative that wasn't presented to me. Talk about how important it is to maybe give some grace, to check your intent, to even reassess and maybe some calm reflection why you believe what you believe and be curious around why they believe what they believe, because increasingly we all tend to see the world, I think, more black and white versus gray. Am I wrong?
You're not wrong. And I think that part of what is confusing right now is that what the research shows is that only 13% of Americans are actually at the polls.
Right, right.
And 87% are in the middle, depending on the issue and where they lean, but maybe they're persuadable. But that's not the impression that we get from the media. And that's not the impression we get from the public rhetoric. And a couple things I think are important. One is that it can feel like we're in a fight about what the facts are. And difficult conversations are rarely about facts. When it feels like they're about facts, often it's where are we getting our facts and who do we trust as sources of those facts? And so that's one thing just to be curious about and understand. A second, and you hit upon it, is what are the values or the worries that we have? And often what I hear is maybe Republicans worrying more about impingements on individual rights, which are really important, and Democrats worrying a little bit more about inclusion and those who are not heard or counted. And both of those things are important. We absolutely need both of them in a working democracy. And in some ways, each side can trust that, like, I know you've got that thing, so I don't need to worry about that thing, but you guys are not worrying about this thing. And this thing is the thing that's being overlooked. And so part of it is, what do we worry most about? And that question, tell me what you're worried about on this particular issue, can be a really rich question to ask over, you know, the dining room table or, you know, while taking a walk with a friend. And not to feel responsibility like I have to change this person. And I think that's also the negotiation we have with ourselves, which is how do I let go of needing someone else to see it the way that I see it? And that's actually not simple.
Sheila, let's pivot from that and talk about the role feelings play in having difficult conversations. One of my top favorite interviews on this podcast is a mutual friend and colleague of ours, Dr. Susan David, out of the Harvard Medical School. She, of course, wrote the book Emotional Agility. Highly recommend this book.
Yes.
And she's just smart and lovely. She talked about the difference between feelings and emotions and experiences and facts. That feelings and emotions are important and facts are important, they're not always the same. And a lot of us will conflate or even present our feelings and emotions as facts, especially in difficult conversations. Will you riff on what is the role that feelings should have, maybe in the setting of a leader having a difficult conversation with another peer or leader, or perhaps someone on their team? Give us some reminders on how, on where the role of feelings play, and sometimes when does it get the best of us?
Yeah. Well, the first thing we should do is draw a distinction between talking about feelings and understanding feelings and being emotional. Being emotional is often where we're letting emotion leak out in tone of voice or volume or word choice or accusations, et cetera. But talking about emotions and the role that they're playing is actually crucial. And it's crucial because our instinct is often as a leader to, like, can we leave the feelings out of it and stay objective? But in fact, feelings and thinking are pretty intimately intertwined and influence each other. And by the time something becomes a difficult conversation, typically you actually have at least two problems. At this point, we've got a surface problem, like, you know, which strategy should we pursue or who should we promote that we disagree about. But sitting under that is a second problem, which is how we each feel treated by the other when we have these conversations. I feel like you're not listening. You're not weighting my view in the way that I think it should be weighted. You're not even curious why I think this person that you're promoting is a real risk, or that you're overconfident about them, or that you like them because they're like you. And we're not having that conversation. So if we don't talk about how we each feel treated, this deeper problem, we might solve the surface problem. Okay, fine, whatever. But this problem is going to raise its head again in some other form next week. And so we're not really getting to the heart of what the conversation is at least partly about.
One of Dr. Covey's passionate topics was this idea of declaring your intent so that there is not a confusion around your intent. And there's a whole skill around making sure that you declare your intent, because lacking that, people may ascribe one to you, and even one that's perhaps malicious or nefarious. Absent facts, people make stuff up. One of our phrases at Franklin Covey we teach our clients is intent counts more than technique, because sometimes your technique, your delivery, can be incongruent with what your intent is. You have a whole section where you talk about don't assume anything, and the chapter is titled Disentangle Intent from Impact. Explore that a little more, how important it is to understand intent and impact.
Yeah. So part of what's interesting when you're an observer to a conflict is that it's easy to see the ways in which two well-intended people are actually having terrible impacts on each other. Or when I need to raise something with a team member, gosh, they're lovely and they're working really hard at this, which is part of why it's hard to raise this issue with them. And what they're doing is having a bad impact on other people or on the project. And so part of the trick is to just separate those two and treat them independently. So I don't know your intentions, because intentions, other people's intentions are invisible to us. So I have no idea what your intentions were, and I'm assuming they probably were fantastic. And here's the dilemma, which is the impact that it's having is actually, I suspect, not what you intended. And the impact is actually the problem that I'm concerned about. The first instinct is the other person's going to defend their intentions, and that's fine. That actually is helpful, because understanding that they actually had good intentions helps me understand what kind of problem we had or we have to solve. If they didn't have good intentions, we have a different kind of problem. But if we just operate with those two thinking about each on their own merits, it actually makes the conversation much easier to have, and it makes it much clearer. Because as you point out, the more history we have together and the more frustrated we are with each other, the easier it is for me to feel the negative impact from you and just assume you must have negative intentions. So you talked over me in the meeting. You must be actually trying to, you know, take credit for my work or undermine me or control everything. It's just the way you are. Intentions become characteristics, become character. Over time as well, which is really corrosive to the relationship.
Repeat that phrase, because that was fire. Intentions become characteristics over time.
Intentions become characteristics, the kind of person that you are, that now become character. And that story that we start to tell about other people's character is corrosive to the relationship over time.
We'll have people replay that a few times. Sheila, give us a 3-minute masterclass on what the leaders, the parents, the spouses, the friends, the sons-in-laws that do this best, what do they have in common? What are some of the practices and principles that people who have the best success in difficult conversations? 3-minute masterclass, go.
No pressure. So number one, I think they have very clear thoughts about their purposes for having a conversation. What am I hoping to accomplish with this conversation? And those purposes are oriented around things that I can do. So it's not, I need to get you to change or agree or get on board. It's, I want to share with you the thinking behind why we're doing what we're doing, or I want to understand what makes you hesitate. Those are things that I can do because they're oriented toward me. The second is that those purposes are oriented around curiosity, that I first need to assume that my view is partial, meaning both self-congratulatory, it skews toward thinking of myself as the good person here, and it's also partial, meaning incomplete. So I actually need to understand what you can see that I don't and why you see it differently in order to understand the problem that we need to solve. And then that I'm actually including an understanding of what is the role that emotions are playing here and how we each feel treated, and let me walk my own talk in being open and curious and listening well. And what role does identity play in why this feels high stakes for us? Because the framework sitting under difficult conversations is the same, no matter who you're talking to or what you're talking about. It's a conversation about what happened, is happening, and should happen, which we disagree about. It's a conversation about feelings and how we each feel treated. And it's a conversation about identity and who we are or want to be, and the ways in which how we're showing up in the conversation either helps that or actually can disable us. So I think the people who are best at it walk in with some preparation on each of those fronts, and also an awareness that it is very much a two-way journey of discovery in order to have a learning conversation.
You know, I think the best piece of advice I've got in my career was from Franklin Covey's chairman, Bob Whitman. I served as the CMO of Franklin Covey for nearly a decade. And he said to me once, thinking is a legitimate business activity. And I think that's great. Such profound advice, especially in a world where everybody is crazy busy, hyperactive, and always in momentum. And what you really basically said is some of the best ways to have difficult conversations is to prepare, is to, you know, understand your intent, understand your identity, understand the other person's journey and narrative and what is a win for them as well, too. And that going into these haphazardly or with high emotions or emotional is not a ingredient for having great, difficult conversations, that you need to think about those things and maybe not rehearse, although you might do that, but the best way is to be thoughtful about it and think about it before you headstrong charge into it.
Yeah, and I think that the trap that we all can fall into is, gosh, I don't have time to prepare. And number one, I would say I'm laying awake at night thinking about it, so I might as well take that time, you know, or commuting in the morning, dwelling on it. So I'm already spending the time. I should just purpose it towards something that is useful. And the second is I don't have time not to prepare, because even 10 minutes of preparation or 2 minutes of preparation as I walk down the hall or search for the Zoom link means that I'm going to save 7 hours or 7 weeks or 7 months, because we have a better conversation now and come out the other side actually understanding and tackling the right problem, rather than I go in and wing it and advocate for a view and we leave each feeling more frustrated and unheard, which now is going to fester in the business and in the team.
Or $7 million in litigation. So let's talk. Yes, right.
Well put.
Yeah. I don't have 10 minutes to prepare, but I have 7 months to actually be deposed. Let's talk about, let's elevate this. What if you're dealing with someone who you are convinced has bad intent, has dishonest track record and brand, or perhaps is just a bully or a liar or a person of low character? How do you prepare? How do you facilitate these conversations different when you have concrete evidence that this person has different character than you think you do?
Yeah, I'm really glad that you asked that. I'm sure everybody listening has someone who comes to mind for them. So I think part of what you're asking is, how do you be clear about what the other person is contributing to the problem and not shy away from it and hold them accountable for it? And I would say that is crucial and something that we often overlook or shy away from because we don't want to blame. And so part of what we talk about when we talk about what happened is that our instinct is to ask, whose fault is this that we're having this problem? And if I've got a bad actor on my team, whether it's on purpose or not, sometimes they're well-intentioned but can't help themselves, right? They're reactive, they yell when they get upset, whatever. The impact is a problem. Rather than simply blame them and remove them, I also want to take a look at, well, what are we each contributing to this problem so far? And it's not 50-50. It might be 90% them, but it might be 10% me as a leader, because I haven't addressed this in the past. I've tolerated it and I haven't brought it up. Or it could be, I've put them in a position where they have access to impacting more people than they should, or I've put them in a role where it's not their strong suit. And so they are frustrated a lot of the time. The purpose of finding my own contribution is partly so that I can change my contribution and be accountable for it myself, so that I know, well, okay, here's what I need to change. I might need to take them out of the role. I might need to raise it, to have a conversation about it and find something to try that will make it better. If I own my part of it, I'm in a much better position to insist that they also own their part of it and to say, I can't change this by myself. So here's what I need you to do to change. I'm curious why it's happening, and it needs to not happen again. So I think that you can be quite explicit about that, and sometimes you can also frame it as a dilemma. We've talked about it several times. You've insisted that you have good intentions. You're still having the impact. I'm trying to understand that, and I'm also feeling a responsibility to make a decision that limits that impact, for example.
Wow, that was beautifully said. People are writing that down right now because they're going to redeploy that in their life, which is the valuable...
Under the heading of prepare for conversation with fill in the blank.
Yes,
right?
I think it's great. Send us off with this final conversation. Are difficult conversations easier or more difficult in a hybrid virtual digital world now? Is it easy? Is it more or less effective, more or less difficult to have a necessary difficult conversation virtually? What do people do better or worse? Give us a couple of insights around that.
Yeah, well, so this is one of the things that's new in the third edition, which is that we have a 10 questions people ask in the back. And one of them is about the many channels of communication that we have these days, you know, Zoom, Slack, et cetera. So partly, of course, it's harder when you're not face-to-face in most circumstances. It's also harder because Slack, text, email, all of those channels are not really dialogue. They are actually serial monologue. And so it's tempting to default to hiding behind, well, I'll just type it out and tell my side of the story so that, and then I don't have to be there when they react to it. The problem is they're triggered by your story and what it leaves out, and now they write you back an email that's just as frustratingly one-sided. And this is one of the reasons why conflict can escalate much faster on virtual teams and via email, Slack, text, et cetera. Often there's often an audience, right? Because you've got other people CC'd, and that raises the stakes identity-wise for everyone. So generally speaking, the more important the conversation, the more important it is to have a real-time dialogue. Usually in person is best, partly because there's more to read and there's more connection to make. And you can sit down, have a cup of coffee, and have a more exploratory conversation to understand an important problem. Personally, I think people have different preferences between Zoom and the phone. And there are some ways in which I listen better on the phone, because I'm not distracted by trying to read all the visual information. So I'm actually really clued into listening carefully to what someone is saying, and maybe even while we take a walk, you know, in separate places if we can't get together in person. Other people prefer Zoom. And so I think that's maybe a conversation to have with them, which is like, hey, we should have an important conversation about this. What's your preference? Do you want to do a phone call or Zoom? Or, you know, I will be there next week. Do you want to get together then? Some of that is a conversation about how to connect so that we can have the best conversation that we know how to have.
Sheila Heen, professor at the Harvard Law School, founder of the Triad Consulting Group, New York Times bestselling author, and perhaps most credible in difficult conversations as the parent to three children. Thank you for joining us today on Leadership. We appreciate your time today.
Thank you so much, Scott. It's been an absolute pleasure.
And we'll see you back here next week for a new conversation on leadership.